To change one's place is to change one's nature, writes Barbara Grizzuti Harrison, and that's one of the reasons she travels. Harrison recently spent several months traveling through Italy. Her new book, Italian Days, is part travelogue, part memoir. She writes about the architecture, the food, the traffic, but at the heart of the book is her search for family and faith. Harrison's parents left Italy at the turn of the century. She was raised in Brooklyn as a Jehovah's Witness, a subject she wrote about in her book, Visions of Glory. Years after she left the Witnesses, she became a Roman Catholic. On this trip to Italy, she tracked down her Italian relatives and tried to find her place in the church. Harrison's other books include Unlearning the Lie, Sexism in School. Her essays, reviews, and profiles have been published in the New York Times, Harper's, The Nation, Ms., and Esquire. During part of her trip through Italy, she was joined by her daughter. The rest of the time, Harrison traveled alone. I asked her if she enjoys traveling by herself.
Very much. I'm never lonely when I'm alone. And this is probably extremely self-centered unless you think of a city as a character, not just as having character, but as being a character, as being an object of love. I like relating in a very intimate way to the city as an entity. And I find even with wonderful and good friends and companionable travelers that my attention keeps getting divided and shifted between the person and the city, and I truly do prefer to be alone in the places I best love.
You say that in Italy you never felt so much made in God's image. Would you explain that?
I think because in Italy God seems to be part of the family. He doesn't seem to be remote. He certainly doesn't seem to be punishing. And one, first of all, Italy is so physically beautiful that I always think of something Louise Bogen, the poet, said. She said, if there is no God, why is the universe not dark brown? Italy is certainly not dark brown. And there are reminders of God and of his extended family, and in particular of Mary, all over the place. And I don't by that mean only the great cathedrals. I mean street shrines, which are to me enormously touching. You know, people put flowers in beet jars in these rather homely street shrines, some of which, by the way, are Renaissance masterpieces, others of which are folk art. But one feels as if one is living in a very God-filled world. And one recognizes oneself in great paintings. One sees oneself in some role. One sees one's grandmother, one's aunt, one's mother, one's baby.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Rome, you wanted to find your place in the church, so you literally went shopping for a church. Before we get to the one that felt most comfortable to you, what did you find in certain churches that were alienating to you?
Well, you know, you may know, Terry, that a lot of Catholics have a very hard time these days feeling very much at home in any given parish, and I sometimes think that the heroic Catholics are those who go to their neighborhood church and sort of live through a homily about how we need a new roof, while at the same time thousands have died in a hurricane in Sicily or someplace, or live through a liturgy in which women seem not to exist. These are, of course, things of concern to me. I believe absolutely in what an Italian friend of mine, who is an iconoclast and a great disbeliever, calls the story, by which he means, and I mean, the fact that God became man, became human, shared our human condition, died, and was resurrected. I believe that absolutely. But I don't like an awful lot of priests, and I don't like the feeling in an awful lot of churches. And so in Italy, I think, and I think now out of a great deal of vanity and stupidity, I looked for what I wanted. What I didn't like, may I tell you what I didn't like?
Yes, please.
I didn't like the American church, which is to say the expatriate church. I realize that American expatriates need a social center, but I think the danger is it becomes parochial and they talk only to one another. People are perfectly capable of loving Italy for 20 years and never learning a word of the language. And I thought it was in some ways small and petty. I am made very much uncomfortable by charismatics. I always think I'm going to need Valium when people start talking in tongues or having ecstatic experiences. I think ecstatic experiences are something that should be kept very quiet and very private. So that and of course I don't I would it would be impossible for me to go to, not impossible, I would do it because the heart of the church is the mass, and I suppose I could bring myself to do it, but if it were particularly sexist, I would be extremely unhappy. What I wound up doing was going to a neighborhood church. Now, I had the advantage of not understanding every word that was being said, but I like those neighborhood churches. I thought, well, this search is meaningless. I am going here to celebrate Mass. And so that's what I did, and I stopped feeling restless after a while.
What was the scale of the church? Was it a large church? Was it small? Was it modest? Was it filled with art and with shrines?
It was rather small, but you know, to say that means we're talking about Rome now, are we?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was rather small, but to say that means almost nothing, because in one dim corner there is a Caravaggio, so in that way it was magnificent. But it was friendly, and it was, you know, the Italians use church as if it were a living room. They walk up and down, they talk with their friends, they cup their mouths with their hands and comment on the puerility of the homily, they ask for alms. And there's this, again, kind of familial relationship with God, which I found rather cheery and comforting and nice.
You visited many cathedrals while you were in Italy, and you raise a question that I think is a really interesting and a really important one about cathedrals. Does the scale, the massive scale of a cathedral, uplift and exalt the soul, bring it closer to God, or does it reduce you to feeling the size of an atom and feeling small and unnecessarily insignificant?
It's a good question, isn't it? I mean, it's a question that's been vexed by better people than me. Dickens talked about this a lot. Hawthorne talked about this a lot. Henry James, of course, was obsessed by this question, and often staged scenes in cathedrals, I think, precisely in order to answer this question. I think I came to think that it really depended entirely on the cathedral. You know, during the Counter-Reformation, a lot, at the beginning of the Counter-Reformation, a lot of the cathedrals were emptied of many of their art treasures and many of the statues. And so they became, to my mind, these bare and sterile places where not only did I feel insignificant, I don't mind feeling insignificant, of course I am insignificant, certainly compared to God, but I felt agoraphobic. And I don't mind feeling insignificant, but I do mind feeling agoraphobic. I don't feel that way in some of the busier cathedrals, busy with art, busy with people, busy with candles, busy with light, busy with stained glass and wonderful light and air that's almost chewable. It's so dense with color. But I don't, you know, this question of feeling insignificant is an interesting one, because it is sometimes exactly at the point at which you feel that you are nothing, that you are compared not only to God or to the church, but certainly compared to art, compared to the weight of history you feel around you. It's exactly at that point where you feel your own lack of significance that you simultaneously feel exalted and happy and very much part of that, so that the distinction is then eroded. And the question of significance and insignificance almost becomes mooted. It disappears. Does that make any sense?
I think it makes a lot of sense. Barbara Grizzuti Harrison is my guest, and we're talking about the subject of her new book, Italian Days, which is part travel guide and part memoir about her recent trip to Italy. Where do you go to church in New York? I mean, you don't have to name the church, but you were talking before about the difference between shopping for a church or just going to the neighborhood church.
Well, I'm out of town a lot, and this is a way of hedging, because I'm having the same problems in New York of finding a church, and perhaps I should just resign myself to going to the one two blocks away from me. I might very well do that. I think if one starts looking for the perfect liturgy and wonderful music and a progressive-minded priest and stuff like that, that sometimes one just gets in trouble, because after all, part of the thing about church is community. And your community doesn't exist in the most beautiful church in New York, which happens to be a $25 taxi ride away from you. I don't know the answer to that question. I'm shopping again after swearing I never would.
Okay. You know, we're talking about churches, but you're really, in a way, a convert to the Roman Catholic Church. When you were growing up, you were a Jehovah's Witness.
It's like saying I was a teenage werewolf. I don't know if...
How do you mean that?
Well, I mean, it's an aberrant sect, isn't it? Or so it seems to me now. It's joyless. There was a wonderful line that Dorothy Sayers, who was, I think, an Episcopalian, no, she was Church of England, said, and that was the only sin that love can commit is to be joyless. And do you know the only holiday they celebrate is the death of Christ? Not even the resurrection, but the death of Christ. And they do that by having a very rather glum and grim meeting. So for me, I know for so many people who were raised, people of my generation who were raised in the Catholic Church, the church seems restraining, confining, repressive. For me, it is, of course, it was enormously emancipating because I grew up so straitjacketed in a sect that told me what to do every moment of the day, censored my thoughts, my dreams, everything. And so becoming a Catholic, and I must say that I was baptized as a Catholic as a child, so maybe it took like a vaccination. In that sense, I'm no more convert than everybody who makes the decision every day to be whatever he or she is. Becoming a Catholic for me was really opening a door into freedom. I mean, I can disagree with people. I can disagree with the priest, a bishop, and the pope, and nobody can do anything to me except disapprove.
What could they do to you when you were a Jehovah's Witness?
They could excommunicate me, which they call disfellowshipping. They could impose upon my mother the imperative never to speak to me. They could dictate to everyone who knew me not to talk to me. And in fact, at my mother's funeral, nobody did talk to me.
Were your parents Jehovah's Witnesses?
My mother, whom I've learned to love since she died, was, and my father was not.
So you were brought up as a witness?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how did you leave? When did you leave?
I left with great difficulty. I was 22. I had been a Jehovah's Witness since I was 9. I worked in their headquarters building doing jobs that women did then, which is to say I made 30 beds a day and washed 15 floors a day and stuff like that. And work which a disaffected Catholic will, of course, say nuns do too. So it wasn't the nature of the work so much as the fact that I wasn't allowed to think a thing. And it was sort of like what I imagine living in a communist country 10 years ago might have been. If one had a doubt, one couldn't tell anybody because you'd be turned in. I forgot your other question. How did I leave? Oh, I went a little nuts. I mean, I just became so unhappy that even I noticed it. And this is very odd. These are these wonderful serendipitous things that happen in one's life, and one doesn't know how to account for them. I went to get glasses. The doctor said, I don't know what's wrong with you, but you're seeing things that aren't there. You're not seeing things that are there. Whatever you're doing, get out. And so I did.
So you left a religion that you found to be both all-encompassing and punishing.
Mm, yes,
and
indeed.
Did you go for an extended period of time before getting going back to religion through the Roman Catholic Church?
Many, many, many years. I don't know if I can even... when I say many years, I mean almost 20 years.
That's a long time.
Yeah, sure it is. Yeah, I had two wonderful kids. As far as I knew, I was wonderfully happy. No, that's not true. I was, you know... I was okay. Wonderfully happy sounds too Mary Poppins. I didn't understand that what had happened, and this is what I think in retrospect, was that the Jehovah's Witnesses had created a need that they'd never filled and they'd never satisfied. I mean, there was still a need for God. Goodness, I sound so religious.
Well, are you? I mean,
am I? I'm not pious. I mean, I think anybody who had ever heard my confession would tell you I was not a very good person. But I'm answering your questions, and they seem to be taking us in that direction.
Barbara Gazzutti Harrison is my guest, and her new book is called Italian Days, and it's about a recent trip to Italy, in which the book is part travelogue, part personal memoir, and religion is one of the many issues that she discusses in the book. Part of the reason for your trip was to look for distant relatives. Your parents were from Italy, and you wanted to meet some of the people who were still there, part of the family tree. I think it must have been really a kind of unusual experience to see people who had the same genetic pool but were living completely different lives.
You're not kidding. I mean, because when does those tricks with one's mind, well, suppose I had not been born here, suppose I'd been born there, and you go through this whole list of logical impossibilities, trying to imagine what your life would be like under an olive tree in a courtyard with chickens running around. It is dislocating, disorienting, and ultimately extremely satisfying. I'm not even sure, although I've written about it at great length, in what way that too fills a great need to see yourself reflected in another culture. It's almost like finding a lost part of yourself, a part that's been split off or a part that's been behind a kind of curtain. I saw myself in those people. I loved them very easily. Their love was so forthright, so simple, so sweet, so easily given. And that was amazing to me after the guardedness, the insularity, this almost claustrophobic kind of feeling I got very often from my Italo-American relatives. I'm not sure that Italians always transplant well, by the way. And as you may imagine, I have Bensonhurst somewhere tucked in the back of my mind.
Did your Italian relatives not understand why your family left Italy?
No, they did not. They certainly did not. And you know, I'm not sure I do either. Well, I mean, one knows all the obvious reasons. They were very, very, very poor. Think how poor you'd have to be to leave the Bay of Naples for Jersey City. I mean, you have to be really poor. But no, they had it was incomprehensible to them because their world, my Italian relatives, their world is narrow, which is not to say it's not deep, but it has certain very set boundaries. And this alien activity of leaving one's homeland seems to them a kind of affront, and they're wounded by it. They understand that there is another world, but they don't quite understand why anybody would want to know it any more intimately than they need it. They have what they want. They are craftsmen. They carve. They make cheese. They make wine. These are indeed wholesome and wonderful activities. It seems to them that there is nothing better to do. And no, they don't understand. They understand that we come back looking different and smelling different and saying weird things.
Have what they want. They have what they want. I bet that's something that you're really not used to.
Well, no.
Experiencing, right? Someone who's always thinking about, should I shop for another church or go to the one in my neighborhood, you know?
No, I don't have it, and I don't. I mean, modern life is not conducive
to
this kind of mindset. Exactly. I don't know anybody who has what he or she wants.
Yeah.
Do you?
Well, I mean, you never even know what it is that you want.
Yeah. That's the first problem.
It's one of the basic dilemmas.
Yeah.
Italy is such an old country. One of the things that I think is really interesting traveling across America is to, say, compare parts of Florida and New York or parts of Los mm-hmm. Angeles and New York, and you have this comparison between the old and the new. And you go to Italy, which is far older than, say, America's oldest cities.
Yeah.
What kind of experience do you get from being in a city that's very, very old?
The same kind, and I hope you understand that this is not morbid, the same kind of experience I feel in a graveyard or a cemetery, which is a rather comforting one. I mean, one just thinks of life as a continuum and death as part of it. And it goes on, and one has a place both in life and in death. Even the landscape, you know, in Italy is old. Even, for example, in Tuscany, one feels everything is willed. There is nothing arbitrary about the embroidery of the kilns with cypresses and grapevines and olive trees. They didn't do it that way to look pretty. They did it that way over thousands of years because that was the way to cultivate the land. So that you begin to feel almost as if even where a cloud falls between mountains, that the cloud has volition. And it's nice. Maybe it inclines me to a little bit more fatalistic attitude than I have in New York. But I think what it does is I'm not afraid in Italy as I am in New York, since everything in Italy seems to be what it has to be. I mean, it seems almost ordained. And I think that's the effect of an older civilization, whereas this one, so new, and also to me, it seems to me so tragic at this point in our history. Perhaps it doesn't have a long way to go.
You write that to change one's place is to change one's nature. And I think a lot of us feel when we travel that we've been somehow transformed by the experience. And then we wonder as we take that journey home, how much of that is going to stay with you and how much will you just immediately fall into all the same patterns as before and become exactly who you were before? What have you found? How much does that sense of change last when the trip is over?
Well, I think there are a couple of answers to that. One is to get a frequent flyer bonus ticket so you can keep going back and getting a new fix. No, I think it sticks. I think among the I lived in India for 4 years. That certainly stuck. I mean, I think about poverty and about human suffering in ways that I might not had I not lived in India. But Italy, I think, once it transforms you, truly does. The effect it had on me and continues to have on me is a deep happiness, which amounts to a kind of praise. I'm so glad it's there. It just seems incredible to me that one can just get on a plane and be there. And you know, people have found it transforming and are usually, I may say, when they're not scribbling. I mean, most of us who scribble about Italy are far more articulate on the page than we are when we're babbling alive. They've all felt transformed. It is the transforming country, and it just does something freeing and wonderful. And that's a combination of light, air, food, people, landscape, art. It all comes together in the most beautiful and human way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks.
It was fun, Terry. Thank you.